Ladies and gentlemen of the internet, welcome to episode number one of 90s DVD Rewind. My name is Mike Halper. I am coming to you from Cleveland, Ohio, and I bring with you my cousins, Nick and Justin. Nick, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Hello. I was expecting Michael to say one thing and decided that he was going to say something else, so we will not go with our pre-planned joke. My name is Nick. I am from West Long Branch, and Michael has decided to drag me and my brother Justin into an adventure where we watch some exciting movies from Michael's childhood, the 90s.
Hey, everyone. I'm Justin. I'm 22 years old. I live in New Jersey as well, and I'm excited to go on this journey with you guys and to watch 90s movies. I know we've been talking about this for a little while, and happy and excited to get going.
So here's kind of the genesis of how we got here today and why you are listening to us. Several weeks ago, I said to my favorite cousins, Nicholas and Justin, I said, I'm going to come visit you guys. I'm going to drive the 8 hours from Ohio, spend a weekend with you guys. Justin just graduated from college down in Virginia Tech, had a couple weeks to himself before he had to become a big boy and start working. So came up for the weekend, and on Thursday night before I left, I said, you know, one thing we could do is watch a couple good movies. I know you guys haven't seen all my favorite movies, so let's figure out a few you haven't seen. Maybe we'll watch some over the weekend. I send a list of about 30 movies, thinking, there's got to be, you know, 5 or 10. Maybe I'll pick 2 or 3 really good ones. And Justin is the first to respond to me. And Justin's response is, I have never seen any of these movies. And after I stopped practically crying out of shame for myself, decided, you know, we have to do something about this. I'm 40 years old, was born in 1979. I'm actually 39. I'll be 40 later this year. Grew up in New Jersey. When I was 26 years old, moved to Ohio. Came out here for some schooling, finished that, enjoy it, like it here. So I've been here. Now, that was 2006 when I moved out here. Nicholas and Justin were, what, 12 and 9 at the time? Does that sound about right, guys? Maybe.
Quick
math. It's real easy. You take 2006 and subtract the year you were born, and whatever's left, that's how old you were.
Whoa, mind blown.
It's pretty awesome. I learned that at school in Ohio. So it's my fault. You know, I'm the oldest cousin in the family. We have a big family. My father is brother of Nicholas and Justin's father. They have 3 other brothers and 2 sisters. So that's a family of 7 siblings. Everybody's got 2 kids. I think, what do we have? 15 cousins on that side. So big family. I'm the oldest. It's my responsibility to make sure that people watch good movies.
Yeah, Michael, educate us.
While I'm gallivanting in Ohio, my 12 and 10-year-old cousins or 12 and 9-year-old cousins are watching SpongeBob and
playing Halo.
There's nobody there to get them to stop watching SpongeBob. So I get back to New Jersey 3 or 4 weeks ago, and Justin is still watching SpongeBob.
What's wrong with SpongeBob?
So that was kind of the genesis for this podcast. It was, you know, let's find a way to watch these movies. I've got to figure out a way to make these 2 young bucks accountable to me to actually sit down and watch these movies. So I'm going to start a podcast. I'm going to invite them on. And by invite them on, I'm going to basically say, you guys are doing a podcast with me and it's going to be awesome. So now they are going to watch movies. This podcast hopefully will go on. We're going to try and do it every week for, you know, maybe 50, 60 weeks. But we're the first week that we get on and somebody says, yeah, I didn't get a chance to watch the movie. We're done. So we could have a sudden stop to this podcast. I don't have time to be assigning movies to people and have them not watch them. So it kind of started as I put together a list of movies from the 70s, from the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s.
It's a big list.
And then it's a really big list. And then all the movies from, you know, before 1970, which there are a lot of good movies.
No, black and white movies suck.
Yeah, black and white movies stopped in like the 40s. So there's still a lot. And there are some good black and white movies. Citizen Kane, the greatest movie of all time.
Nope, black and white. Way. Fell asleep on that movie four or five times.
Well, then you were doing something wrong.
Dr. Strange Love, you're going to say that one too. That movie sucked.
I haven't seen it.
Oh,
I know it's a great movie.
It's in black and white.
One of my favorite all-time actors who also starred in Being There, which came out in the 1979. Dr. Strangelove it's a Stanley Kubrick movie. How do you not love it? I don't understand.
Black and white just bores me.
Have you seen Clerks?
I have.
Oh, you have?
I have.
Wow. You didn't mark that off on the list.
I did.
You left it as
you. Oh.
No. No, you poor guy. Another great one is where's the list? I forget the name of it right offhand, but well, whatever. That's neither here nor there. So I have this list of hundreds of movies, all of which I own. I have a very large movie collection. I have a lot of Blu-rays. I have let me turn around and count them. 18 shelves.
Oh, I thought each. You were caught. I'm counting movies.
No, I'm counting shelves. I have 18 shelves, each with three tiers. So that is 54 shelves, each about 22 inches long, filled with Blu-rays, a lot of movies.
Wow.
So the list got to be prohibitive, very prohibitive. And then we said, well, what are we going to call this podcast? And kind of had to kill two birds with one stone and say, all right, well, DVD Rewind is taken. Rewind is taken. Movie Rewind is taken. 90s movies is taken. Blah, 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 blah. So I finally put together, and this is how I imagine everybody comes up with names for things now. I have to find something that nobody's used. So I have to put together three different things in a way that nobody else has ever put them together before. And we come up with 90s DVD Rewind. It also just so happens that the biggest decade on that list of great movies was the 90s, because that's when all the best movies came out. You know, in your early teens to late teens, that's when you're probably most impressionable in your entire life. So all of my favorite movies come out of there, probably 1994 to 2002 is really the sweet spot for me. I graduated from college in 02, so I was 22, 23 at the time. So we put together this list. There's a very unique qualifier for movies for this podcast. It has to be a movie that I have seen and a movie that Nick and Justin have not seen. So there are going to be some times where you look at this list and you say, oh, how did this movie not get on your list? What it probably means is Nick has seen it. It does not mean Justin has seen it, because he has only seen SpongeBob.
Probably going over your list from, you know, pre-70s to the 90s, I only remember checking off two movies as seen, and those two were Back to the Future and E.T. So, yeah. So Michael is right on about that. I've seen nothing.
So you've seen, yep, Back to the Future, E.T., and The Breakfast Club.
Yes.
And Karate Kid. There we go. Four.
Okay. Wow. All right.
So somebody has fairly good taste and showed you those good movies. Mm-hmm. So where we get to now, you know, being the guy coming up with the list of movies and then crossing things off as Nick tells me he's seen them, I'm the only person here who's seen them, who can say, hey, you know what? This movie will make a great podcast. The first movie we chose for that is 12 Monkeys. So this week, we are going to rewind 12 Monkeys on 90s DVD Rewind. Kind of the format for this show, I assume that you've seen 12 Monkeys. If you have not seen 12 Monkeys and you would like to someday, then you should turn off this podcast and go watch it and then come back. because I am going to tell you right up front what the plot of the movie is. We're going to talk about what we think of it. We're going to talk about our best, the best performances, our favorite scenes, our favorite lines, everything in there. It's not a general review show. Don't, you know, there's enough people doing that. This is just going to be three different perspectives. You know, I'm coming from late Generation X, 1979. Nick is coming from a late millennial. And then Justin is an early Generation Z. So we've got three different perspectives. Nick and Justin are close in age. They are not close at all in anything else. They do not like each other at all.
Yeah, you want to fight?
They do. They like each other. But they are not in the same place right now.
That's so they don't like.
Whoa.
So that brings us to 12 Monkeys. Off the top, talk a little bit about the movie. Came out in 1995, limited release at the end of the year, probably to try and get it in for award season. It was released on a wide scale first week of January 1996, released by Universal Pictures, directed by Terry Gilliam, who also directed a movie called Brazil. He's directed, I think, 12 or 13 movies. Interesting fact, Terry Gilliam was a member of Monty Python's Flying Circus. He started out as their animator and then became a full-fledged member of the comedic group. I've never been a big Monty Python fan, not my brand of comedy, the brand of comedy being English. So I don't know what to tell you there. I've never seen him do anything for Monty Python, but he was there and I've heard of it. So there we go. The movie starred a big star at the time, Bruce Willis, coming off Die Hard.
Best Christmas movie ever.
The best Christmas movie ever. I only saw Die Hard for the first time maybe 4 years ago. Whoa. Because like I said, I'm the oldest of our cousins, which means nobody showed me good movies. I had to find them myself. Your father is an utter failure. He did not ever bring me to the movies, but he redeemed himself because he would bring me to WWF wrestling events. And those were awesome. Again, Bruce Willis, Madeline Stowe stars opposite Bruce Willis. She is I don't remember if she's a psychiatrist or a psychologist. The difference being one is allowed to prescribe drugs and the other is not. Guest starring Brad Pitt, Christopher Plummer, David Morse is the horrible bad guy. And in an early role, Christopher Maloney from Law and Order SVU fame, who I have never liked in anything he's ever done, including this movie.
Wow.
Interesting fact, Brad Pitt's performance in 12 Monkeys, it was a breakout performance. He was just coming off of Interview with the Vampire, Seven, and Legends of the Fall. Those were, I think, his last three movies before this one. This got him his first ever Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor, got him his second Golden Globe nomination. His first was for Legends of the Fall the year before, and he won the Golden Globe. And to date, it is still the only individual Golden Globe or Oscar that he's ever won. So this movie should be famous for that, if nothing else. It's the only movie that Brad Pitt won an award for, a meaningful award anyway. The movie grossed about $57 million in the U.S., about $168 million worldwide, had a $30 million budget, so it was considered a huge success. $30 million budget might seem like a tiny little budget. Apparently, the rumor is Bruce Willis and Madeline Stowe both took pretty hefty pay cuts from their normal rate to work with Terry Gilliam. People kind of considered him a brilliant director. The movie was co-authored by one of the authors of Blade Runner, starring Harrison Ford, which came out in the early 80s, another great sci-fi movie. This movie, 12 Monkeys, it was released on video in January 1997. Interesting fact, my father manages a small pharmacy. In 1997, they had a very large video rental section, and I got to rent VHSs for free. So that is how I saw this movie. I took the VHS home and watched it in my VCR. For those of you Nicholas and Justin's age, A VCR is like a cassette tape player, but you've probably never heard of that either. So what it is, it's a little, like a little rectangular square with tape in it, recording tape. And that's how they recorded things. You put it in a player, it spun it, and I don't know, creates pictures, goes to the TV. So there we are. The first DVD release was March 1998 in the very, very early days of DVD. This movie was absolutely one of the first DVDs I ever owned. Like I said, it came out on VHS in January 97. That is probably about the time that I saw it for the first time. Critically, did really well. It has an 89% on Rotten Tomatoes, Tomato Meter, 88% audience score. On CinemaScore, it has a B, which is a solid. Don't know a whole lot about their scoring system, but you know, if I got a B, my parents didn't yell at me. So I think that's pretty good. Roger Ebert, you guys may know he has a website. He's been dead for a long time. In the 90s, he was one of the top critics in the world. There was a show called Siskel and Ebert, and they would give either thumbs up or thumbs down. So getting a two thumbs up was great. Freestyling here. They probably wanted more money. When the internet first came out, they thought, hey, I can do my own thing and make just as much money just by myself, not have to deal with the other guy. So they split up. Roger Ebert went on his own. Gene Siskel went on his own. Nobody knows who Gene Siskel is. Roger Ebert still has one of the best movie critic websites in the world, even though he's been dead for like 10 years. The movie 12 Monkeys, it is a how to explain it. It is a post-apocalyptic sci-fi time travel mystery. Now, normally when a movie has that many genres, it's going to be a mess. But somehow Terry Gilliam kept this from being a mess, which is part of the reason that makes it so great. It was based on a French short film called La Jetée. And Terry Gilliam said that even though the screenwriters based the script on La Jetée, Terry Gilliam never bothered to watch it. He said he was intimidated by source material, so he avoided it at all costs. Very, very brief summary. Roger Ebert, the illustrious critic I was talking about before, called this movie a celebration of madness and doom. So Nick, Justin, you guys might now understand why I love it. Very brief plot summary. Bruce Willis plays James Cole. James Cole is a prisoner in a prison in the 2030s. He is picked to go back in time because 5 billion people have died. 99% of the human population is gone. And very interestingly, they're sending Bruce Willis back in time to try and figure out how to get a copy of the plague that ended up killing everybody so they can bring it back to the 2030s, distill it down, figure out a cure, and then cure humanity in, I think it's roughly 2035. That's your plot. About 10 years later, I think in 2005, Bruce Willis tried to make this movie again with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, the kid from Third Rock from the Sun. They called it Looper. It was basically the same movie, except way worse. So if you've seen that movie, you should forget it and go out and get 12 Monkeys. So here we are. Now we are at the point of our podcast where we would ordinarily play some kind of theme music, bumper music, something like that. Our budget did not allow us to do that. So let's just pretend we're listening to Pearl Jam or Nine Inch Nails, a nice 1990s musical experience.
Here, Michael, just quick correction on your brief plot. Scientists' plan right when Cole got enough information was to then send someone back to that time to study it more in depth. And that's what you see in that final scene with Dr. Jones on the flight sitting next to Dr. Peters.
Correct. Exactly. They send Bruce Willis back to figure out how to, you know, again, the goal is bring a cure to the future, cure humanity in 2035. That's actually one of the more interesting things I find about this movie that really separates it. It's a very smart time travel movie, which you don't see a lot. Most time travel movies have really, really big plot holes where it's like, well, if they could go back in time, why didn't they just do this? In this movie, it's a very established plot point that they're not trying to stop this plague from killing everybody. They have no intention of doing that. There's even a part in the movie where Bruce Willis is sitting in front of a panel of doctors at the mental institution, and they say, oh, are you here to save us? And he says, no, of course not. This already happened. I'm trying to fix it in the future. It's a very deliberate approach and kind of fatalistic. You know, there's nobody in the future thinks, hey, let's go back in time and stop this from happening. They're just trying to figure out how to cure it in the future that already exists, so their lives can be better going forward. Very, very unique plot point, very weird kind of thing. There's not really an explanation for it, but they hit that plot point enough times in the movie where it becomes an accepted fact. I don't see that as a plot hole, more as a, you know, there's a universal view of the world in this apocalyptic future that tells them, no, going back and stopping this is not the right thing to do.
So what'd you give it a score, Michael?
This movie is one of my 20 favorite movies. For me, if we're going on out of 10, it's a 10 for
me.
It brings together a lot of things that I love. It brings together post-apocalyptic Earth, which is my favorite Earth. It brings together some weird science. I'm an environmentalist. I love animals, and you know, I have a hybrid car that gets 60 miles per gallon. I don't shove it in people's faces. I don't tell other people what to do, but you know, I bring my own bags to the checkout at the grocery store. So I enjoy the getting rid of humanity so everything else can flourish, because as Ultron determined in the Avengers movie.
Great movie.
Biggest threat opposing the Earth is humanity. So that's a great one. And three, Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt had a roughly 10-year period where he was the best actor in the world by far. He was in this, he was in Fight Club, he was in Snatch, he was in Interview with the Vampire, he was in Seven. I mean, he was just crushing movies for a good 8 to 10 year period around here. In my view, this is, you know, there's a reason this is the only movie he's won an award for. I think it's his best role ever. Really enjoyed the way he played it. Found out in doing a little research for the podcast that he actually went and studied with a psychologist to figure out how to be a mental patient in the movie, and kind of learned, you know, mental patients are not crazy people. They're people who just occasionally act crazy. You know, most of the time they're perfectly normal. It's just when they're not, it's dangerous for other people or themselves.
Well, I don't know if you're going to like my score, because I gave it half the points that you gave it. I gave it a 5. my general thoughts on the film was that it was confusing when you first start out on the opening scene with the dream, which is later revealed as a flashback because it is something that has already happened. I felt that it really didn't pick up steam until the middle part of the film. You're kind of left with so many questions and no answers until you really start to get into the behind the scenes of why does this really matter, and who are these big wigs, and what are they really trying to get out of this time travel? There were certain scenes to where it seemed like everything was a jump cut. Didn't really have great flow going from one scene to the other. The biggest thing that I'm confused about comes from Bruce Willis' character, James Cole, and his flashbacks, because at the 37-minute mark, you see a flashback to where Brad Pitt's character, Jeffrey Goines, is the one running through the airport in the yellow jacket with the briefcase that has all of the viruses in it. But you later find out in the final scene that it's not Jeffrey Goines. He was actually running a raid to just take all the animals out of the zoo and lock his father up. So I'm confused on to how that scene may have changed, if something in history altered that, and why was it that we saw that first scene as Brad Pitt and then later it was somebody else. I thought the ending was kind of bleh. I mean, we had seen it from the beginning, the middle point, and to the end, so we knew what the inevitable truth was. It wasn't like anything was going to be altered. It just needed to happen because, as you stated earlier, Michael, when Bruce Willis's character, James Cole, is at the Baltimore Institute in 1990, he's like, this has already happened. This can't be changed. This is something that is going to be the same regardless, unless you want to try to create a different timeline. So he understood as they got closer to that point, I'm assuming that he was going to die when he realized that, oh, I've seen myself die, which is kind of screwed up a little bit, that as a little kid, you maybe might not have known, but as you got older, you're like, oh, that's me. I'm going to die in the airport, and my little self is going to watch that over and over again. That's just kind of a terrible, terrible way to go. But that's kind of why I gave it a 5. Was just, I kind of left the film with more questions and answers. Didn't really feel like it ended that well, and really want to know how those middle scenes and those flashbacks really changed or were altered as the movie continued from beginning to end.
I gave this film an 8, definitely more on the higher Michael side with this film. I guess going along, you know, kind of like what Nick said, first even 2/3 of the film are kind of slow with everything developing and you're learning all these things. But that last half, that last third of the film were phenomenal to me. And I can see how it's easy to get confused throughout the movie, but at the end, you should have a pretty clear picture on what happened and ultimately the end result. And I felt why I gave it such a strong rating, you know, like I said, was the ending. And, you know, the curveball the audience is thrown with the realization that Dr. Peters, not the Army of the 12 Monkeys, is behind the spreading of this virus, you know, really caught me off guard, because given everything that had happened, you know, prior to the airport scene, you have every reason to believe that it is Jeffrey or Brad Pitt and his army behind the virus, given, you know, his father's the doctor, and you know, you see him working in his lab, you see the phone call between him and Catherine playing it down. And, you know, it has me thinking, oh, he's just saying that, like, you know, like he totally has, you know, this plan that he's going to execute. So, you know, so like I said, I thought the ending was phenomenal. You know, just a few things to point out. You know, he goes back, you know, back to the 90s, you know, this time trying to get to 1996. Ends up for a few minutes back during World War I and gets shot, and then immediately is sent to 96. I thought he did a lot of, even though he was limping, I thought he did a lot of moving around with a bullet in his leg, and maybe it doesn't matter. And, you know, as serious as this movie got at times, I thought it was a little funny when Bruce Willis puts on the fake mustache and wig. And to me, he seemed like a mix. Hopefully you guys get this one. He seems like a mix of Jason Sudeikis and David Spade to me. And for the rest of the movie, I kind of just was giggling and had a grin on my face, given his appearance.
I think, Nick, on your comments, this is a movie that you need to watch more than once. There's a lot of threads that the first time you watch it, they don't make sense. But, you know, I'm the kind of guy, my favorite movies are movies that I've seen a dozen times or more. I've seen this movie a dozen times, at least, if not more. I've seen it twice in the last week. I love Brad Pitt's performance. I love having to figure out, like, it is a mystery. It's like, why how did he get here? And then why did he go there? And why do they keep pulling him back and forth? And how did this Jose guy get in the World War One? Why was it, what was going on? You got to watch it through a couple times to really get all that stuff. Now, if you don't like post-apocalyptic movies, then maybe it's not worth a second sitting. But if you like that style, like I love the visual look of this movie. I love the way the futuristic scenes are set up. I think it's done really good. You know, at the same time, I get movies have changed a lot in the last 25 years. So, you know, the one of the best examples of that is Clerks. Clerks came out in 1994, I think. And it was absolutely revolutionary. Nobody had ever done anything like that before. If you go back and watch it now, other than the nostalgia, it's terrible because movies do that all the time now. You know, it was kind of the Quentin Tarantino vibe of, hey, why are these movie characters talking about real people like Madonna? You know, that. So it does have a special place where there weren't a lot of movies like this at the time. There weren't a lot of time travel movies. There weren't a lot in this style and this vision. So I, you know, for, like I said, 90s have a lot of nostalgia for me. It was very impactful because of my age at the time. So this was the first movie I ever saw like that. And I do really, I enjoy chasing down all those threads and thinking about it, trying to figure it out. Some people don't. Some people just
time travel's very weird.
It
you
is.
Know, to think the concept of, you know, how does time really work? Is time linear? Has the future already been determined? Can things be altered by that? And, you know, that's one of the big things that, you know, you kind of have to open yourself up to as you watch this film, because, you know, as Michael pointed out, and, you know, we talked about that first beginning scene. Well, what if all of a sudden in that moment in 1990, you know, he isn't, you know, put in the insane asylum? You could say, well, the chain reaction of events, you know, which we then find out that 12 Monkeys was only created because Bruce Willis's character talked to Brad Pitt's character.
Exactly.
You know, Jeffrey Goins doesn't ever think of the idea of the 12 Monkeys unless he runs into James Cole. Now, if they had sent him to the right time, you know, what would have happened then? And, you know, you start to sit there and think, you know, has this already been determined? Do they know, you know, do the scientists know? Do they know that they have to send him to the wrong time? And are there certain things that they know they have to do to get to where they want to go? You know, is there a lot of pre-planning in all of this? And that was something that, you know, it's like you said, it's hard to wrap your head around. I mean, there was just, you know, the Avengers Endgame that had time travel in it. And it's something that, again, it's very hard to try to figure out, whether it be Terminator 2, Back to the Future, 12 Monkeys, Avengers Endgame. I mean, it's something that we still don't really grasp, and everyone's going to have a different interpretation of how time really works and what happens when you try to alter it or try to change something in it. But my big continuity issue is that 37-minute mark of the flashback. If everything that James Cole is seeing is real, it's not a dream, it's not fake, how is it that Dr. Peters and Jeffrey Goins are switched in one of his flashbacks? And that's kind of my, you know, big take on what was there done or what happened that may or may not have made the characters change places, or was that just something that was made up in his head?
Right.
You know, I can't really figure out, you know, and even going back and watching it again, it was like, okay, you know, he's asleep. You know, Justin mentions the bullet in his leg. Maybe there's something to do with the fatigue and just being, you know, the blood loss and not really being fed properly. Like, does he imagine that it's Jeffrey now? But you then start to think back to the film. It's like, well, wait a minute. He hasn't met Jeffrey with long hair yet. So the only way he would have seen him is if when he was a little kid, and that's how he has the memories inside of his brain. So that's something that is really interesting. And, you know, I don't know if there is an answer to that. I don't know if maybe something happened. Maybe that phone call that Catherine made altered, you know, the scenario to where all of a sudden the father changes the passcode to when Jeffrey captures him. Now it's about releasing the animals and not getting the virus. Who knows? You know, we really don't know all of the details behind it. But to piggyback off what you said, Michael, I think Justin would also agree with me on this, that Brad Pitt should be the slam dunk for best performance of this film. I mean, he really just exemplifies what they were looking for in Jeffrey Goins. And I did, you know, some research myself, and they weren't even looking at, you know, Brad Pitt or Bruce Willis originally for Cole and Goins. But I really think that they hit a home run with Brad Pitt playing Goins, and he did a phenomenal job from beginning to end, really fit that character well.
I agree. Absolutely. So Justin, who do you think best performance?
Join the club.
I would say watching the film, I really wanted to say it was Bruce Willis, just given, you know, the frequency of seeing him. And I understand Brad Pitt is a supporting actor in this film. But I guess what I saw from Bruce Willis, I really liked. But towards the end, and what I saw from Brad Pitt in Goins, and also given, you know, he gets nominated, wins the Golden Globe. How do you not go with Brad
Pitt? Yeah.
I thought he did an awesome job. And, you know, you talk about him, you know, studying and really preparing for this role. And, you know, just me reflecting on how he portrayed Goins, you know, he does have, you know, a handful of sane moments with, you know, real thought and real reasoning, you know, also along with these crazy, you know, really just these crazy moments, without a doubt. Brad Pitt.
Yeah, slam dunk.
Well, I'm going to I'll accept your challenge, and I'll tell you why it's not Brad Pitt.
No, that's not how this is supposed to work.
You know, Brad Pitt, clearly breakout star, stole the show, stole every scene he was in, clearly. But for me, he wasn't in it enough. You know, I think the only person who could have as little screen time as Brad Pitt did and take away the best performance would be Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs. Have you guys seen that classic, wonderful horror movie?
No.
Take a guess.
You guys are embarrassing me. All right, next week on 90s DVD Rewind, Silence of the Lambs. No.
What? I thought it was True Romance.
We'll keep True Romance just to keep the Brad Pitt thing going. To me, the absolute best performance, naked Bruce Willis.
What? That's so specific.
Did you see how often he was naked in this movie? There were like seven scenes of naked Bruce Willis. He just could not keep his clothes on.
I was not counting. In the shower, World War One.
I'm pretty confident Bruce Willis was on screen naked more than Brad Pitt was on screen.
I might have to go back in time that now.
We also got Bruce Willis's rear end and Brad Pitt's rear end. Brad Pitt decided to show off his derriere for a little while. But in all seriousness, to me, Bruce Willis, and here's why. And it took me watching it a few times to really appreciate the job that he did. In the beginning of the movie, when he's a prisoner, he can barely string three words together. He can't say full sentences. He's a blithering idiot. He then develops, you know, he's really trying his hardest to do the job for these 20, 35 scientists. He really feels like he's an integral part of this mission to go back and help them find the cure. So they can bring it to the future and cure the human race, and they can go back and repopulate the surface of the earth, because they're all stuck underground because the air is poison. Then from there, he falls in love with Catherine, or whatever, likes Catherine, whatever. And then he moves to, well, maybe, you know, I've been taught my whole life, I can't change the past. I've just got to try and fix the future. And he kind of then morphs into, well, maybe I can change how things happen, and I can have a life with Catherine, and I can stay here. You know, he pulls the tooth out. He doesn't want them to come get him anymore. To me, that transformation from blithering idiot, blubbering prisoner that can't talk, to this guy who is just trying to do his mission to get his pardon so he can get out of prison in the future. And then it becomes, you know, now it's the mission, not just to save himself, but to save humanity. And then it turns into, no, I don't believe, you know, they've been tricking me. I don't believe what they're telling me. I'm going to try and stop this and save the world. And it all turns out to just be this inevitable loop, which is why I say the movie Looper, also starring Bruce Willis, is basically the same movie as 12 Monkeys, just not nearly as good. I love that character arc. You know, 2 hours is not a whole lot of time to develop a character, which is why I prefer 10, 13, 20 episode long seasons to movies generally. But they really did a great job bringing that character from point A to point B to point C to point D, then coming around full circle to point A again. You know, that
EFJHIJKLMNOP.
No, there were only 4 points. Blithering idiot, trying to get a pardon, trying to save, trying to find the cure, trying to save humanity. A, B, C, D. Mm-hmm. Get it right. And that's the loop. You know, the end of the movie is the beginning of the movie. So you're left to wonder, through Bruce Willis's character arc, is anything else real? Or are we just going through this endless loop over and over again? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. So Nick, you don't like the movie, clearly, Nick. Five. You might as well have just given it a two.
Well, I mean, I was thinking of going that low, but I mean, there were performances in there. I mean, sometimes you're going to find movies to where you thought people did well in the roles that they were given and necessarily look at the plot as a whole and just kind of like, eh. I mean, I could get the whole virus thing and, you know, what they're trying to do and looking for it, but just too many continuity issues, just too much confusion in the beginning for a 2 hour film for an hour and 20. I mean, if you take Justin's approach, you're looking at 66-67% of the film basically just being bleh. I mean, I don't know how you can give it more than a five if you're looking at almost 2/3 of it being bleh. Overall,
I can give you two reasons.
Naked, okay.
Naked Bruce Willis.
Naked Bruce Willis.
And Brad Pitt.
I guess for those that would be watching at home, if that's what you're going to decide to choose on why you'd give it more than a five, I'd love to hear that.
If you like Naked Bruce Willis, this is the movie for you. Justin, I think I heard you start to say something there before I ask Nick another question. What do you?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment on the ending. You know, it being able to piece it together and just how I guess smart and masterful it is with Jose coming back with the gun, trying to give it to James, and then specifying, if you don't take this, I'm going to kill Catherine. And having watched that whole scene and giving it some thought, the whole reason behind that is we need to stop anyone that's going to impact what's going to happen. And, you know, given Catherine's actions in the airport, she's very much trying to stop Dr. Peters from, you know, flying to all these different places to spread the disease. And then, you know, confusion could arise when, you know, Bruce takes the gun and is not specified on what to do with it by Jose. And to me, that's because he knows that he'll be killed in the airport, right. Which will complete the loop. I just thought the ending was – I thought it was awesome. I really did.
Before we move on, how great was David Morse as Dr. Peters? How creepy was that guy?
You know, I was interested to see the scene to where Catherine gets kidnapped. If you go back to when they're inside the building and she's going over – the World War One scene to where the I can't remember what was his name. You guys just said it too. He gave Bruce Willis the gun. What was that character?
Jose.
Yeah, where you know she's talking about you know this doomsday scenario to where you know this plague and all this stuff happens. And you know, there are people there listening, you know, intrigued about what she's saying in the book that she's writing. But he's legitimately there trying to be like, how do I make this happen?
Right.
You know, what am I going to do, you know, to get from where I am right now to actually causing mass destruction? And you don't really notice it at the time because you just think that he's one of those individuals that's just curious and really intrigued by the data and what she's saying. But he's really like, no, no, like, I want to make this happen. Like, how do I actually make this happen? And that's kind of creepier when you go back and realize what he did, all those steps he was taking. Even the phone call scene to where Goins' father is on the phone with Catherine and Peters is in the lab with him. And he's like, we're going to beef up security. Make sure you beef up security. And he's the first one to be told. And now he's able to take precautions to make sure that he can still get what he wants and make sure that no one knows about it.
Right. So, Nick, your vitriol and hatred of this movie, notwithstanding, what was your favorite part?
I think my favorite part had to be when Catherine discovers that time travel is real. You know,
is that when she sees the picture?
Yeah. So she gets the phone call from the police saying that the forensics team has come back with the bullet and realizing that it's from, you know, World War One in France. And she starts to have an epiphany because now she's freaking out because she knows that she's talked about the man, Jose, who was in France and was speaking English and didn't know any French. And she goes back and looks at this photo and all of a sudden there's naked Bruce Willis, the theme of this podcast, in the background of the photo. Woo! And she's like, oh my God, he was actually telling the truth the entire time. And here's the proof of it. And now she's going back and reading.
And man, is he hot, naked Bruce Willis. Wow.
Yeah. And there now becomes a complete, you know, 180 of her approach as to, oh my God, we're all going to die if we don't do something and I need to help him and I need to find him. And she goes back and talks to, you know, the old doctor that she worked with in Baltimore. And now she even has more evidence with the barn incident because that was Bruce Willis as a kid. He was hiding in the barn. And it goes to show that she is now very concerned because the fate of the world is now not only resting in his hands, but also her hands, because she knows how what's going on right now works. You know, this is her time period. She knows the ins and outs, where to go, what to do. And Bruce Willis's character has been providing all the information. The only problem is with her discovering that part of time travel, she accidentally creates a paradox of herself by calling the phone number of the dry cleaners and leaving the message, which confuses them to think that the 12 monkeys is behind everything.
How do you not think this movie is brilliant?
Because
like
I
everything
had a
you
wait,
just told me, you're telling yeah, me, you're like, look how freaking good this movie is.
Of the movie to get to that point.
2/3 of the movie starring naked Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt. It's great.
If it was 66% of naked Bruce Willis, might have to change this to an NC-17 rating.
No, it was fine. It was fine. It was tasteful. It was tasteful, naked Bruce Willis. I'd like to inform you guys, this movie is actually probably the closest that I've ever come to watching a porno movie. Wow. I've never seen a movie with someone naked in it so much as this one. All right, Justin.
The more you know.
Justin, you like this movie because you're reasonable and rational. What do you think best part of the movie was?
Best scene, I went with the mental hospital scene where Jeffrey is able to get his hands on the key and then causes a scene for James to escape and kind of just wander throughout the hospital. I guess prior to that point, you know, not a whole lot of crazy stuff had gone on, in my opinion. And even looking back at it, given, you know, finishing the movie, I thought it was the craziest and, you know, a pretty interesting scene, given he's able to get the key and, you know, cause the scene, dance with a woman, just be an absolute nuisance for him to make his escape. I thought, I don't know, I thought it was a good scene. And there were, you know, there were plenty of, you know, good scenes throughout the movie, but I went with that one. It starts at 29:27.
All right. I have kind of an honorary, and it's not the scene. It's a very, very specific, maybe 10 seconds. And then I'll talk about my favorite scene. The 10 seconds is when Bruce Willis is being interviewed by the five psychiatrists or psychologists or some mix of those. And he says, "I'm not crazy." And one of the guys says, "We don't like to use that word in here." And I'm paraphrasing, but Bruce Willis is like, "But this place is full of nuts." I thought that was great. But my favorite scene, and this is where I differ with Nicholas and maybe even Justin on where the movie, where the switch flips for me. And I think Nicholas, this is right after the 37-minute mark. It was right after that part of the movie you were talking about. It's the World War I scene. The World War I scene is where, you know, the beginning of the movie, they say they're going to send him back in time. They're going to send him to 1996. He ends up in 1990. And he's there. He calls the number and you know, some lady with screaming kids trying to cook dinner answers it. And she's like, "I don't know what you're talking about." They figure out he's there. They pull him back into 2035. Now they're trying again to send him to 1996. It doesn't work. He ends up in France in World War I. No idea how. They never explain how the time travel works. You know, it's pretty clear that they don't really know what they're doing. So we get naked Bruce Willis in Paris in World War I. The French soldiers are surrounding him. They don't know what to make of this weird naked guy with a bald head. And then two soldiers are carrying a stretcher with a wounded soldier on it. And it's freaking Jose. And he's looking for Bruce Willis. James Cole. I'm looking for James Cole. And that's where it hit me. Like, wait, this is his fellow prisoner. They sent James Cole back, Bruce Willis, but they can't get him back. So they sent someone else to look for him. And then all of a sudden, Bruce Willis wakes up in 1996. And you have to think that through. It's like, so they had to send Jose to find him. They get Jose back. Jose tells them where he is. They pick him out of the time stream. And then they put him in 1996 where they wanted him originally. Finally, on the third try, they finally get it right. I thought that scene, that's where the movie turned, where I realized this is not like any other movie I've ever seen. And again, that this is happening in 1997, 22 years ago. I've seen other movies like it since, but this was the first one. The way that scene was shot was phenomenal. It was dark, the smoke, it looks green. You know, like the whole background is green. It's really surreal. It almost, that whole scene kind of looks like a painting to me. I just really liked the way it looked, the way it was shot. Like I said, that scene was really meaningful to me because I thought that's where the movie turned for me. And it's right about at the 40-minute mark. So about one third of the way through, not two thirds of the way through, or for Nick, never. That's where the movie turned for me. So that is our initial thoughts. Something else we're going to do here. My second favorite cousin, Nick, is a
sports.
He's a broadcaster. He graduated from Monmouth University in what, 2 years ago? Is that
yeah.
right, Nick?
Yeah.
2 years ago, broadcasting degree, likes to do sports stuff. So we figured, since he clearly doesn't know what he's talking about with respect to movies, we will give him an opportunity to talk about something he does know a little bit about. So
one Nick, film in and my credentials are shot.
Here is, now again, we don't have music yet, but let's pretend here we take a 10-second break. We listen to maybe some Stone Temple Pilots, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. All right, Nick, your sports interlude.
Yeah, go. Sports. Suck sports. Yeah, so in the sporting world, everybody knows on the East Coast, the teams in the New York area seem to get the most attention, whether they're good or bad. And we clearly see that with the New York Knickerbockers as they missed out on every top free agent that was available for this upcoming season, except for Kawhi Leonard. But everyone seems to believe that he is going to be joining the Los Angeles Lakers. Guys, I don't know how more embarrassing James Dolan could be as the head man with the Knickerbockers. I mean, you didn't give Kevin Durant the max. You couldn't get Kyrie Irving to come. Didn't even get a shot at Kemba Walker. And I don't even know if you were able to sit down with Kawhi Leonard. What's going on with the Knicks? I mean, Wayne Ellington? I mean, what are you thinking?
Who would have ever guessed when the Nets and the Celtics made that trade for Garnett and Pierce? Who would have ever guessed the Nets would win the championship?
Oh, that's the other thing that I love about that. You got to love that too.
Props to the Nets for digging themselves out of that hole. And, you know, after this year, Durant healthy, why, you know, there's no reason they can't come out of the East. Yeah.
Worst thing that ever happened to the Knicks was the Nets moving to Brooklyn.
Oh, absolutely. The brand power.
You know? Oh, I'm sorry. That's the second worst. The worst is Dolan.
Yeah, he's number one. It's just very interesting and very disappointing that the Knicks had the worst record in the NBA, failed to get the number one overall draft pick, didn't really get the greatest reaction when they drafted RJ Barrett, and then to make matters worse, they don't get Anthony Davis and they don't get any of the good free agents that are out there. Fail, fail, fail. And now it's going to be even more interesting with this upcoming season, because everyone's sitting there saying, wow, if Kevin Durant was healthy and the Nets win the championship, not only won, to Michael's point, how embarrassing is it that Danny Ainge and the Boston Celtics weren't able to actually capitalize on all of those draft picks that they decided to sit on and do nothing with? But two, Stephen A. Smith made a great point today, which I know we're not the biggest fans of him, but he's like, you can't just sit there and say there's one team in New York anymore. You have to sit there and say that the city of New York belongs to the Brooklyn Nets, because they got two of the top 10 best players in the NBA right now, and the Knicks probably don't have one in the 200 players that are in the NBA right now. That's quite embarrassing. But what is not embarrassing is that the Women's World Cup semifinals, the first leg, finished with the United States defeating England 2-1. Michael, I know that you're not the biggest social media guy, but Justin, I'm pretty sure you saw Alex Morgan trolling England by sipping some tea after her goal in the 30th minute. Absolutely love the gesture there. Gotta love some good old taunting. And the women were able to hold on for a 2-1 victory. We'll be playing on Sunday, which would be 11 a.m. Really excited to see the final Women World Cup. Hopefully United States can come out on top again. But did you guys catch any of the game or the highlights from that match?
Nick, on Twitter, I had saw that we had scored early to go up 1-0. And Morgan's celebration, picture perfect. I thought it was quite funny. And thank God we went on to win the game, because if we don't, that's a terrible look. I did catch our missed penalty. And even though that call went our way with use of the VAR, I didn't necessarily agree with the call. That was really the only part of the game I caught, but I did see that we had won. And, you know, that's awesome going, you know, looking to repeat on Sunday.
I did not get to see any of the game. I was at work today. I have a job. Got home about 7 o'clock and started preparing for this. So I didn't see it. I do really enjoy a lot more than I thought I would watching the U.S. women's national team. I did watch the last two games starting at probably about the 30th minute of both. So I caught about the last hour. Really enjoyed it. I do not like soccer in general, mostly because of the flopping. Same reason I don't like watching NBA basketball anymore. Men's soccer, I've watched the World Cup. This past World Cup was the first World Cup I did not watch any soccer, probably since high school. I just can't I can't take it anymore. But watching the women was refreshing. You know, knowing they were coming in favored, having some time. The last time we had a World Cup, I had a 2-year-old, so I did not have any free time to do anything. But I did watch. I've watched those two games, and I watched, I think, the first game in the first part, the round robin section. So I've watched, you know, roughly three of their games. Really, really enjoyed it. I love Megan Rapinoe. Hopefully she'll be back. I am very excited for 11 a.m. on Sunday.
Yes, it's going to definitely be something that just about everyone has their TVs turned on, their eyes glued to their phones. People will be watching. Whether you are a big sports fan or not, I encourage you to watch these types of events. You see the greatest of the great, these high-class athletes playing on the biggest stage for the ultimate glory, which is the World Cup.
I don't know that it's the biggest stage. I mean, it's in France. You know what would make the final perfect? If right in the middle of the game, boom, naked Bruce Willis shows up right in the middle. That'd be awesome.
Just dead middle, 45th minute before kickoff.
It'd be great.
Awesome. What if he's there watching
the game? Hopefully he streaks.
So Michael's gonna set the odds at +700 for naked Bruce Willis.
I don't know what that means.
It's a betting term for those who dabble in that. But speaking of America, with the 4th of July coming up, Nike was looking forward to releasing their
before we move on to talking about gambling. I've only gambled once on sports. Uh-huh. And it was in 1993 when the Cowboys played the 49ers in the NFC Championship. I'm pretty sure it was 1993. I made a bet. I made a $10 bet against Ryan McHugh in middle school. He never paid me.
Wow.
So Ryan McHugh, if you're listening, you owe me $10.
You should have said there was interest after a couple of days of not getting that.
No, that's okay. I don't need interest. All right, move on.
So Nike was looking forward to reveal their Betsy Ross flag sneakers for this upcoming 4th of July. And they had already shipped out the product, but Colin Kaepernick, who had basically set the world on fire, according to some, last year, told Nike that he wanted the shoes to be pulled back. And that's what they ended up doing. Speaking to the Wall Street Journal, Nike struck down a plan to release a shoe featuring the original version of the U.S. flag this week at the request of Colin Kaepernick. The shoe, the Air Max 1 Quick Strike 4th of July, featured a logo of the original United States flag, that design, which was popular by Betsy Ross. It was obviously the 13 stars in a circle on the back of the heels. Michael, you seem to be taking big offense to this.
I'm not taking offense to it. I'm a big supporter of Colin Kaepernick in general. I'm a supporter of freedom of speech. Too often in this country, especially in the last 5 to 10 years, people think that freedom of speech means freedom for me to speak my mind and not have to listen to anybody else. I do not believe that. I think Colin Kaepernick has the right to do whatever he wants. If he wants to kneel at an anthem, he can go ahead. The only place I took issue with Colin Kaepernick before today is, you know, he came out and like his Nike thing that he did a year and a half ago, where he came out and he said, "I'm willing to sacrifice everything for what I believe in." When you then turn around and sue the NFL, now you're not sacrificing anymore. So that to me, it was like, if you were willing to give up your job to do that, then give up your job. Don't then turn around and sue your employer and say, "Well, I shouldn't have had to give up my job." So that, you know, I didn't like it. But again, I don't hold it against him at all. Think he had every right to do whatever he wanted to do on the field, off the field. I like people who use their positions to try and bring media attention and focus to issues that they care about. On the same token, I don't care what celebrities think about anything, because their opinion means no more than the opinion of any other guy on the street. I'll listen to what they say, but I'm not putting credence into it. I'm not going to go out and vote for somebody because some celebrity told me to. With that said, I have no problem with the celebrity doing that. If you're famous and you want to use it for something, go right ahead. I'm not going to listen to you, but if other people do, more power to you.
But Justin, we've talked about Colin Kaepernick quite often on our radio shows at Monmouth, and the back and forth, the constant questioning of what is really his message. You know, what are we really talking about here? You know, where does this fit into everything that he's tried to promote since his quote unquote exile from the NFL and now being a, I guess, promoter of all the things that he was trying to get across when he was wearing a 49ers jersey?
You know, Nick, I'm with Michael as far as, you know, him saying, you know, whatever he wants and him promoting whatever he wants. And I'm not going to get into the historical aspect of it. I'll just say, as far as the story goes, it really shocks me that his word made Nike pull the, you know, the eventual sales of this shoe. You know, this just seems like, you know, crazy to me, you know, given who Nike is and, you know, what they've done over the course of their existence. But at the same time, you know, you see last year with the advertisement, you know, they go all in with him, and, you know, something that not a majority of people arguably were willing to do. So, you know, maybe, you know, it's seen as Nike's kind of in this, you know, tough spot, but, you know, they did what they did. And, you know, again, Kaepernick can, you know, say, you know, whatever he wants about anything. And, you know, just like, you know, we can, or anyone can. But I just thought it was a very crazy move. Ultimately,
Nike released a statement saying that we regularly make business decisions to withdraw initiatives, products, and services. Nike made the decision to halt distribution of the Air Max 1 Quick Strike 4th of July based on concerns that it would unintentionally offend and detract from the nation's patriotic holiday. Nike is a company proud of its American heritage and our continuing engagement supporting thousands of American athletes, including the U.S. Olympics team and the U.S. soccer teams. We already employ 35,000 people in the United States and remain committed to creating jobs in the United States, including a significant investment in an additional manufacturing center, which will create 500 new jobs. That's a great statement from Nike. I just don't understand why one man's word all of a sudden alters what a entire company, board members, business people came to the conclusion that this was okay.
It's a bullcrap statement. You know, if they're going to pull it, come out. Don't come out and say, "Oh yeah, we do this all the time." Come out and say, "You know what? One of our, you know, very influential athletes has come out and has a problem with it. We understand and appreciate his position, and for that reason, we're going to pull it." That's all you got to say. And, you know, if you're going to pull the shoe, explain why. That's it. Don't hide from it. I don't get it. Everybody wants to keep everybody happy all the time. And people should just stop caring about things like this.
I wonder what they're going to do with the shoes.
They're going to be on African children's feet, like all the Cowboys championship gear.
I mean, I'm glad they're being donated for a good cause. I'm just, you know, really just surprised that it's come to this. It's really surprising that it has come to this. And I would love to know how the board members and how the president, the CEO, and the CFO go about business issues now. Do they have to call Colin Kaepernick every single time they want to do something patriotic? Is there going to be, you know, a meeting with Colin Kaepernick, you know, weekly to be like, "Hey, Colin, we're going to do this. Like, is this okay? You know, we're only going to spend like a couple million dollars to make all these products." But
I think,
you know, it's just very, very confusing on how someone who has no background in any sort of business and any sort of inner workings of products, you know, buy and demand, is now being able to just say a couple words and it's just like, "Oh, yep, we got to just change course because he said so."
I think the takeaway from it is, I just lost my train of thought. I hate when this happens.
Happens to the best of us.
Especially me. Well, anyway, I just to touch on Colin. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I remember now. It was a joke. I forget jokes all the time. The real reason they pulled those shoes, and they're just using Colin Kaepernick as cover. They said to him, "Hey, Colin, we've paid you a lot of money to be an ambassador for our product, and you don't play football anymore. So whenever we put out really, really ugly shoes and want to pull them back, we're going to say you didn't like them." That's my opinion. Hmm. Also, I want to make sure everybody out there knows about Colin Kaepernick. He's a great guy. He's one of those people who puts his money where his mouth is. When he did stop playing in the NFL, he came out and said, you know, I'm not just going to kneel on the sidelines. I'm going to start donating money. And he pledged he would give $1 million to different grassroots charities. And then him and his team go out, make the phone calls, investigate the charities. You know, I've read several articles about him. He does the right thing. He's going out and trying to find local charities that make a difference in the community, and he is giving them money. So, you know, I say all the time when people pop their mouths off about all the things they care about, put your money where your mouth is. He did. He's a great guy. Don't want to take that away from him. I think this position is absolutely ridiculous. You know, the implication that the 13 colonies flag is representative of slavery. You know, Nick, as I think I said to you earlier today, that would mean that virtually every country in the world has to change its flag now, because the reality is slavery was not every country in the world, but I mean, slavery existed all over the globe for a very long time. And if we're going to say every flag that ever flew over a country that allowed slavery has to be abolished, everybody's got to redo their flags. So that
some people say it's the right decision. Some people will say people are being too soft. Some people say they just don't care. But the facts are, if you wanted those shoes, you can't get them, unfortunately.
You can get them without the flag.
Oh,
they did release the same colorway without the flag on the back, so you can get that if anybody wants it.
All right. Add the flag yourself, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, it's not even like it's a good-looking flag. I like it, but I like the current flag better.
Are we
done with sports?
Oh, yeah, this is where we put some cool music, have like a nice little transition, and then we're like, yes. So 12 Monkeys,
now,
and we talk about 12
playing,
Monkeys again.
We're playing George Michael, Listen Without Prejudice. Pretend that that's fine. all right, it's over. So we're back. We're done with sports for the day. That's all the time Nick gets. Nick, you can leave because nobody cares about your opinion about 12 Monkeys.
Peace.
where I was imagining we would go with kind of the next scene when we put together a list of things to talk about is I thought it would be good to do a funniest scene. And I think that because most of the movies that I really like do have funny scenes in them. They have a humorous interlude somewhere or other. 12 Monkeys has some funny lines, but I'm not sure there are funny scenes. So I was going to kind of take the lead on this one, but I'm more thinking, you know, because again, I've got some history. I have friends who love this movie, who saw it 22 years ago. And, you know, my view of the funniest scene is shaped a lot by interactions I've had with those people and things that we've laughed about. So I kind of want to leave it up to you guys. Justin, Nick, which of you thinks you have a really funny scene in this movie?
I wouldn't say I have picked out a funny scene, but moments where I chuckled.
Sounds like you didn't even pick a funny scene.
I wrote down two things, son. Hold on. I thought you were getting out of here.
Oh.
Whoa. All right. So funniest scenes that made me chuckle. I had two that happened at the end of the movie. It made me laugh a little bit when you see all these animals just roaming Philadelphia. I don't know why.
Yes.
But I thought it was a little comical. And then going back to what I had said earlier, where Bruce Willis with the fake mustache and the wig. He's got that Sudeikis / Spade look. It was an extremely serious moment. This is right before he dies. But when he gets through the security, running with the gun in slow motion, you know, I keep thinking about the Sudeikis Spade combination. And all that together just made me laugh. And that's what I had. And, you know, as Michael's saying, this movie really wasn't all that funny, you know, funny lines, funny moments, but not really any funny scenes, like laughing scenes.
One scene that gave me a good chuckle was when James Cole, played by Bruce Willis, which we've probably said a billion times by now. I mean, we've also said that he's naked a billion times. So maybe that's the funniest part of the movie, is just him being naked for like seven times, according to Michael. But in the Baltimore nutcase place, you know, he's talking to all the doctors. He's like, I have a phone number that I'm going to call. And he calls the phone number, and it's a woman with like six or five kids that's like trying to cook dinner. And she's like, who is this? I don't know anything about no recording tape. And you just feel kind of bad for the guy because he's expecting something and it seems like it's just a big sham. And she's just living her life and trying to cook a meal. And she's like, is this a prank? And then you go back to Bruce Willis with just the look of defeat on his face. Like, he's just like, oh my God, am I really insane? It's just like a little brief snapshot of something that I found enjoyable in this movie.
And then Catherine steps in with the, not who you expected, huh?
Yep.
I have one part of this movie that any moment of the last 22 years, I can say it at any given time, and it fits many, many situations. It is from Brad Pitt. This scene was made famous in my head by my friend Nick in high school when we saw this. He said this all the time. Jeffrey Goines was probably his favorite character in a movie. He imitated him all the time. And he did this in school constantly. It's either the first or second scene with Brad Pitt. And I believe it's the first scene because he goes to a chair and he says, this is my chair. And he shoos a guy out of the chair. And then later, the chair is off screen. And Brad Pitt is standing there and he looks over towards where, you know, the chair is. And he goes, get out of my chair, and runs across the frame. And my friend Nick did that in school every day for probably a year. So to me, that is the funniest moment of the film. It's not a funny scene. I don't think it's intended to be comic relief. It's just more, you know, this is the crazy person that Brad Pitt is. But to me, that's hysterical. We've got our funny out of the way. Another fun thing about the 90s is
sports.
Let me tell you guys how much fun sports were for me in the 90s. I'm a Toronto Blue Jays fan. My father is a St. Louis Cardinals fan. You guys and your father are St. Louis Cardinals fans. I'm a rebel. So when I was 3 years old, I said, well, I don't like the color red. I like the color blue. So I'm a Blue Jays fan. Turned out to be a great decision because 1992, I won the Super Bowl and I won the World Series because I'm a Cowboys fan, like any normal person should.
By yourself.
1993, Super Bowl, World Series. 1995, Super Bowl. Five championships in 3 years. Yeah, five championships in 3 years. So 90s were great for sports for me. But no, the 90s were a very unique time. There were a lot of different things going on. You know, we were just getting into CGI graphics and computer graphics and stuff like that. So I thought a good thing to talk about in movies is the design, you know, the sound design, the artistic design, the logos, promotions, stuff like that. This movie is, you know, it's a dingy movie. It's got that sci-fi look. It's dirty, dusty, very, very apocalyptic. Then in the 90s, you've got the 12 Monkeys group hiding out in basically a, God, what would you call it? Like a stall, an enclosed stall on a street in Philadelphia. Just the look of the movie to me was really well done. The 12 Monkeys logo, which was used for the group in the movie and then used for the movie in the real world. I love it. It's got the what are they called? The hanging monkeys, the chain of monkeys.
Barrel monkeys?
Yeah, barrel monkeys. It's got, it looks like one of them, and then it's got this stamp around it. Looks really, really cool. Really like it. The theme music for this movie, I absolutely love at the beginning. It's like a weird, creepy carnival tune, like a haunted mansion. It's got, you know, it's got mystery in it. Oh, I could see them like using this music with Sherlock Holmes. I could see them using it in a weird Scooby-Doo and a horror movie. Really, really enjoyed that. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I really thought it was suspenseful. You know, you're sitting, you know, on the edge of your seat at the very beginning and going back to all the questions that you want answered, and you just hear, you know, I believe it's an accordion that's really the main instrument that's being used in that beginning. It sets this, you know, suspense, post-apocalyptic, not really understanding what's going on theme. And then,
To interrupt. I don't think that was a theme. I just think you didn't understand what was going on.
Oh, maybe it could be. I don't know. I have only watched the movie once. You've told me to watch it more than once, but that's not going to happen because I gave it a 5. I thought that the sound effects that they used and how everything was portrayed, or were they trying to portray it, fit well with the mood and the tone they were trying to set. Again, I really think that, again, I believe it's the accordion is really what makes that happen.
Interesting bit of fact that I found out. That chair, when they're interrogating him in the future, and that chair goes up the wall, and there's like this weird circular thing with all these screens on it. They stole that directly from a painting that some guy made. And he sued
large
them.
Figure.
they had to pay him a high 6-figure sum is what I read. Justin, what do you think?
To comment on the music first, like that intro music, the creepy circus music, that's music that stuck with me. Since I started the film, and I think it's very effective given the type of movie it is. It's this like post-apocalyptic world. You have 12 Monkeys as the title. You have this, this notable logo, this iconic logo. So as far as like the creep factor goes and the impact it has, I think it's very powerful. And another thing I took note of. And was kind of questioning throughout, but actually came to like it and enjoy it, was just the camera angles that were used to show whether it was rooms or characters and their faces. You know, early on, I'm like, what am I watching? But as it went along, it became more normal. And I thought the effect that the angles had on the movie, I thought they served the movie well. I thought they had a purpose behind them.
I agree. I actually noticed, I watched this movie at about midnight last night. I was at work, turned it on. I prepare tax returns and do lots of accounting stuff. So often while I'm working, I'll throw something on just to have some background noise. It was the first time I really listened to the movie without watching it. And I realized in almost every scene, whenever people are talking, there's like sirens really, really low in the background, like as though just cops and fire trucks are driving all around the buildings they're in. Like it seemed almost constant throughout the movie that there were always these real low background sirens, noises, cars constantly. I thought it was really cool. So now that's everything we have on the movie. Other than a final rating and final thoughts to kind of recap, hopefully Justin and I have changed Nick's mind throughout the course of this podcast, but I doubt it. But before we get to that, we wanted to do a special segment just for Justin. And again, because the only exposure he's had in the world is SpongeBob, thought it was a good idea to say, hey, Justin, every week you should bring us something that happened in the 90s on this day. So we're taping this on July 2nd, should go to air, be released to the world on July 4th. So Justin, between, you know, the 2nd and the 4th, in any time in the 1990s, did anything interesting happen at all?
Interesting things that I came across that were interesting, not particularly, but that I wanted to share with you. Yes, I did find those things, and all these events that I have, you know, collected did occur on the 4th. So to start off, we have more sports for you. In 1995, the Birmingham Barracudas, they're based out of Alabama, played their first CFL game and defeated the Winnipeg Blue Bombers 38-10. The Barracudas only lasted one season as they were part of a failed attempt to expand the CFL into the United States. As a sports guy, as a big football guy, seeing this event, like seeing that this happened with the CFL trying to expand into the United States, I thought it was very interesting. And, you know, it's something I wanted to share because previously I did not know this.
And for those people listening, I assume the CFL is the Canadian
yes,
Football League.
That is correct. Also on the 4th in 95, beloved artist Bob Ross passed away at the age of 52.
Oh, that's awful. I have a Bob Ross pop vinyl behind me. I love Bob
Beloved
Ross.
By everybody. You know, plenty of videos of him, you know, talking and painting these masterpieces. Just a, you know, an awesome guy, wonderful guy.
I'm going to paint happy clouds. Nice and happy. Happy little
clouds. Happy little clouds. Happy little
clouds. Then I have two more events. We're going to 1996 now. Hotmail.
Oh, yeah.
A free internet email service is launched, which is now owned by Microsoft, and it is now known as Outlook.com. I'm sure we all have Outlook accounts. I know I use one for work. Nick, I know you got your MSN, you know.
I actually have a hotmail.com email address. Still today. My first email address ever from probably when would it have been? It probably would have been 1996 or 1997.
And I know, having done a little research earlier, I don't know what year this stat was taken, but 400 million people use Hotmail or now Outlook.com. And one more event, following year, 97, the U.S. Space Probe Pathfinder landed on Mars, took some pictures, sent some data back to Earth, and eventually signal was lost with it. But I thought that was cool. You know, I like space. I find it interesting. I know, you know, Nick, going back a while, our family had gone down to Florida. Actually, two things. We had gone to the, I can't think of the name right now. It's like the space station, Kennedy Space Station. Am I saying that right? Okay.
Sure.
I know we had visited it and had seen a lot of different things. And even an astronaut had put on a little presentation we went to. And then another time we had gone down to Florida, I believe it was in 2009, we had gone to the beach and we were able to see, you know, a spaceship launch from, you know, however many miles away. But I thought that was very cool to see. So, yeah. So those are my events on the 4th in the 90s.
I love the 1990s. I did not know. I had no idea that the CFL tried to expand into the U.S.
Yeah, there's actually even more teams. You know, it just happens to be that Barracuda's first game was on the 4th in 95. And, it, you know, obviously all, you know, American teams have folded. Strictly Canadian teams.
America. Bum, bum, bum.
What do you think is going to happen with the XFL? Speaking of expanding football and playing football in the summer.
I think they have their crap more together than the AAF did.
I read an interesting article on the AAF that basically said they never even really wanted a football league. They just wanted to test this betting app. And the guy who bought it and shut it down really only wanted to buy the betting app.
Really? No, I did not.
Interesting. Kind of a conspiracy. Yeah. So they were intending to have an app where you could watch the game. And like side bets would pop up on your app and you could make the side bets directly. And they were going to try and test it in the AAF and then try and roll it out to baseball, football, all that stuff. I forget where I read that, but it was a really, really good. So I'm sure if you have Google, you'll be able to find it.
So you know, a little AAF too, because I found myself following it after, you know, this past NFL season concluded. And the guy who started up, I can't think of his name, the guy who ended up selling it to the, you know, the Hurricanes owner, almost went into it just like, whatever, let's just get into it. And the reason why it, you know, it was shut down is because they couldn't, they almost wanted to, they wanted to operate as a minor league league, like, you know, minor league baseball teams operate for major league baseball teams. And they couldn't get that agreement with the NFL Players Association to use like practice squad guys in their league to like have them play and have them improve. It just didn't develop as, you know, a tunnel for guys to get up. They just couldn't get that agreement. And, you know, it ultimately folded after 7 weeks. I just thought it was a very, you know, foolish thing to start, given you couldn't set out to do what you wanted to do. And, you know, made me question, like, how do you not get that set in stone prior to, like, kicking off your league? Just very weird. But back to the XFL, I think it definitely lasts for more than a year. I'd give it two or three. It's really going to depend on, you know, how invested fans are going to be and how much money it's going to generate.
I have a hard enough time paying attention to real football.
Football. When you root for the Cowboys.
It's excruciating.
I can see why that's the case.
It's so excruciating. How do you do it? How do you, like, do you guys actually watch Cowboys games? Because we get a lot here in Cleveland. And I heard the rumor is the guy that runs the Fox station here is a Cowboys fan. I have no idea if that's true.
I try to watch every single one. So, and I sit there, Michael, and I will go through the ups and downs of the game. And I will sit there and be like, why is Jason Garrett still the head coach? And I'm like, oh yeah, Jerry Jones is still the owner. That's why.
That seems bad.
There's usually a game I miss a year, given something going on, like at school, I'd have events or other stuff going on, and you know, I'd usually miss a game. But I try to watch every game. I'm a lot less emotionally invested than when I was growing up. So, like, if we're to suffer a crushing defeat, like we do all the time, I find myself shaking it off a lot easier and quicker than I did when I was, I don't know, 10.
Sounds like you're just numbing the pain because you're so used to losing. You expect it now.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, they haven't reached an NFC Championship game in my life, and I would kill for that. So pretty much anything good that happens makes me happy, and anything bad that happens upsets me less than it used to. That's where I'm at.
Well, I could tell you guys, you know, being 39 and having seen them win in 92, 93, and 95 at, you know, 12, 13, and 15 years old, it was pretty awesome. And it's been miserable since then.
Absolutely. Well, we have gotten a little taste of it with the Cardinals, but, you know, having already experienced that twice and, you know, knowing how big, you know, football is and how big it's become over our lifetime, like nothing, I guess, I want nothing more than, a Super Bowl as a fan.
So what you're saying is you want Jerry Jones to die.
Oh,
well, yes, I've also made jokes about him passing so we can be successful. You know, also have commented on Jason Garrett's inability to coach. Dak's all right, and I'm about to be I'm going to become rather upset when some mega deal with the Cowboys that's going to set us back X amount of years.
I will be livid. It's gonna be bad when they give Dak Prescott that money. Livid.
You know why I like Dak Prescott?
Why is that?
I heard that he gave 12 monkeys an 8 out of 10.
That makes two of us.
So, circling back full circle, that is Justin Presents today in the 1990s. Let's go ahead and give us some final thoughts. Justin, why don't you go ahead first?
Having learned about this movie and getting into it, halfway, two thirds of the way, I just kept telling myself, you know, this is a very interesting movie. I have a lot of questions, not a whole lot of answers. Kind of slow for me, but that last third of the movie really did it for me. I walk away from the film, you know, 8 out of 10 rating. I thought it was a great film. Definitely a film I will watch again. You know, between different scenes, the complexity of it, the different actors and how they portrayed their different characters. I just thought all around it was a great film. Yeah, that's where I'm at. And I'm really looking forward to, you know, continue to watch great films, hopefully, and to be doing this thing with you guys.
Do you think it's a film that you would watch with your lady friend?
Yes, absolutely. She's seen a lot more movies than I have. She actually worked at a movie theater for a little while. And I guess frequently goes to the movies, you know, with her parents.
Yeah, but you know what? I bet she's seen a lot less SpongeBob.
For sure. Not a whole lot of people have seen more SpongeBob than me. And I'm talking like good SpongeBob. I'm not talking
SpongeBob
like
SpongeBob is good for the soul.
It is. It is. Awesome movie. I'll be seeing it again. Nick, what do you got for us? Has your rating gone up?
Guys, tried your best. I'll tell you, it was convincing. It was elegant. It was well thought out, and I still give it a 5. I'm not changing where I stand. I look at the movie, and I see some good, and I see mostly things that I don't care for, or I'm just kind of like, eh, that kind of stunk. I think that it's a good movie for time travel. Those that are interested in time travel, definitely a movie to watch, really get you thinking. I would say that the Brad Pitt, Jeffrey Goines, and Bruce Willis, James, right? That's what his character's name is, James. Can't even remember right now. See, that's how much I didn't care for the movie. I don't even remember the characters' names, even after talking about it for over an hour. Sorry, guys. You tried your best, but would not be watching this movie again. Kind of a one-and-done deal for me.
I think we should add a new segment to the show, and given that it's our first show, it's not really new. Here's my
question.
I know
that answer,
and I think we should ask this of every movie. Do you think your father would watch this movie?
I kind of have that answer.
Or let me rephrase that as: how long do you think your father would watch this movie?
I was watching it with my mom and dad, and I'd say about 20-25 minutes into the movie, I heard this loud snoring from across the room. And then at about 40 minutes, he had woken up and headed upstairs for bed. So that's how far he got with this movie.
As I kind of said at the beginning, nothing that you guys say is going to change my mind. This has been a favorite of mine for a very long 22 years, just about as long as you guys have been alive. You know, I like this movie more than I like you guys.
Wow.
but I don't love the movie. I love you guys. Love it. Love it. You know, it's a tour de force for Brad Pitt, and he is really the reason I love it as much as I do. He's what makes the movie. He puts in that thing that makes me want to watch it over and over again. It's his performance. He's the guy I quote. He's the guy I remember. You know, if I don't see this movie for a couple of years and you say, "Hey, what's that movie about?" I'll be like, "I don't know, Brad Pitt. He's awesome."
Bruce Willis.
Yeah, I have a terrible... I'm not even tomorrow. I won't even remember naked Bruce Willis. I have a terrible memory. I never remember anything. That's kind of why I can watch movies dozens of times. I know I love them, so I'll go back and watch them, and it's like brand new all over again. But I love it. It's like I said, it's in my top 20 favorite movies. Absolute 10 out of 10. Brad Pitt's best performance ever. One of my favorite actors. My favorite performance of his. It's phenomenal. All right, Nick, take us home.
That is going to be our indoctrination for Justin and myself on 12 Monkeys. We would love to know what you guys think. If you have seen the movie, if you made it this far and didn't see the movie, Michael would tell me to shame you. So I'm shaming you right now that you didn't watch the movie. You should go watch the movie, though, even if you did get this far into the podcast. We would also encourage you to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We want to get some interaction going. We want you guys to follow along as we go through this great journey of watching all of these movies that Justin and I have never seen, and Michael is guiding us along the way. So please be sure to head over to Twitter and look up at 90 Rewind. And then on Facebook, I believe it's at 90 DVD Rewind. Slight confusion for you guys throwing there.
It is. It's It's facebook.com/90s90sDVD rewind.
Beautiful. Beautiful. At 90sDVD rewind on Facebook, as Michael said, and then at 90rewind on Twitter. We will also be making sure to get this audio out on as many platforms as we possibly can. We would like to thank Anchor and Zencastr for helping us create this content and producing it to as many listeners as possible. Looking forward to our next adventure, as Michael had mentioned, is going to be True Romance, which stars a bunch of people I don't know, and Brad Pitt. So, Michael, if you want to give the audience a little tease on that before we close out on episode one, which featured 12 monkeys.
Yeah, so next week we're going to rewind True Romance, written by Quentin Tarantino. I believe it was his first screenplay that actually got turned into a movie. Came out in 1993, stars the illustrious Christian Slater, one of my very favorite actors, who patterned his manners of speech after the great Jack Nicholson. Patricia Arquette plays his girlfriend. And we have got a star-studded supporting cast. You've got Dennis Hopper, Val Kilmer, Gary Oldman, the great Christopher Walken, Bronson Pinchot, who you may remember as Belky Bartokomos from Perfect Strangers. Samuel L. Jackson's in it, Michael Rapaport, James Gandolfini, Tom Sizemore, and the great, great, great Brad Pitt.
Michael Rapaport. I've only ever seen him on Undisputed. I'm actually going to get to see him in a movie now. Wow.
You are.
I mean, nuts.
You know what? We might have to, if you have not seen Michael Rapaport in a movie, we might have to put Higher Learning on here with Ice Cube.
Ooh, the Cube.
One of the greatest soundtracks of any movie of all time. The real quick plot, True Romance, a comic book nerd falls in love and steals drugs from drug dealer Gary Oldman. That's how we start. Val Kilmer plays Elvis, and it's phenomenal. So that's what we're going to come at you with next week. We are all done. Hopefully these guys can keep watching movies that I tell them to watch, and we can keep talking about them.
We got you, Mike. Justin signed the contract.
Yeah, I'm signed to X amount of podcasts. I'm with you every step of the way, and I really enjoyed doing this one. And I'm looking forward to True Romance and all the other films we're going to be watching.
All right, signing off. This has been 90s DVD Rewind, looking at 12 Monkeys.
Insert exit music.
Boom. That was fun.